why he's in rehab. Tom Chaplin of Keene, they had to cancel their American tour and everything. Oh, it smells so nice in here. I'll tell you, Deepak Chopra's producer doesn't always get out of here on time, but it does smell lovely. Because this is not that cheap incense. This is like very classy. I may go over there and buy some. I bet they sell this. I'm going to have to find out what kind of incense this is in here, because it smells lovely. I may even listen to the program someday. He did it! My Patrick did it! Patrick J. Buchanan's book, State of Emergency, made number one on Amazon. And I would have just said it, I did say actually yesterday, it will never get to number one. Because the number one book is The Fat Smasher's Diet. And I just, you know me, because I know everything. And I'm going, he's never going to get to number one because you're never going to beat a diet book. Nothing is ever going to beat a diet book. And son of a bitch, he did. He beat the diet book. So there's more people that hate the immigrants than are fat. Well, then know that they're fat. Isn't that? And I got my copy. I've been trying to get him. Alex has him Thursday. But I asked so late, and I just emailed the guy at the book company. I said, you know, if he's swinging through New York a second time, because sometimes they do that, then I'll take him, you know, the second time around. Because I'm not going to get him to I'll never get him to number one on Amazon again. What a perfect book for a perfect time. State of Emergency, The Third World Invasion and Conquest of America by Patrick J. Buchanan. It is just, it's hard. Do you know that a study came out that said, like, within 5 years, 35 of the 50 most populous cities in America are going to be a minority white. But that isn't even, you know something, it's not about color. It appears to be about color, but it really isn't. I'm trying to move stuff out of the way. I went to my mall on Saturday, the Queens Mall. Queens, the most diverse borough in America. And I swear to God, 90% of the people shopping in that mall were not speaking English. Now, the first thing I would do, I not only would make English the official language and stop this crap. If you can't vote in English, don't vote. If you can't drive in English, don't drive. If you can't go to school in English, screw you. Because I'm for English immersion. None of this bilingual crap. I'd make a law that when you're in public, you can't speak another language either. I swear to God, do what you want in your own house. But if you're in a mall, speak English. And it's not, but it is in color. You see, because so many of the immigrants are coming from Mexico, it becomes a thing of, you know, Spanish and God, is he good looking. Spanish and Mexicans and all kinds of stuff. No. Because you walk around this mall and nobody is speaking English. White people are not speaking English because all the white people are from Europe, you know, from the former Soviet Union countries. And they're white people, they're blondes, you know. So and they're not speaking English either. So, like, nobody is speaking English. I don't even know what people are going to do. Remember the story of the Tower of Babel? That's the problem we're going to have. I went to what is it, Gloria Jean's Coffee. Because, well, actually, this mall does have a Starbucks, but what's right near the entrance is Gloria Jean. And there's two girls are the cashiers taking orders. And it takes 10 years to take an order. Because first there's a woman speaking Spanish trying to order something. And there's an older woman who barely could speak one word of English, you know, so that takes forever. Then there's a woman who's like, I don't know, Egyptian or something, you know, something like that. She can barely speak English. So these poor girls that are trying to take the orders, they don't know what anybody wants. There's like this total language barrier, and it's not even... You know, the thing I would hate, you know, is that they would only hire people who were bilingual, you know, who could speak Spanish and English. Well, if these two girls had spoken Spanish and English, it only would have half helped them. Because then the other lady would have come, like the Egyptian lady, and wouldn't have helped anybody, would it? So people from Mexico and South American stuff should not take this personally, because it's not about them. It is about people coming to this country illegally who don't want to assimilate. It's not about them coming. You know something? If they came, even illegally, say all these illegal people were here, right? And they all got here and they said, you know something? I snuck in here. But I am just devoted. I am going to become a real American. I am just going to become an American as American can be. And I am going to learn English. Nobody would notice that they were illegals, would they? Would anybody notice? It wouldn't be quite so obvious if everybody was walking around speaking English or making an attempt to speak English. That's what it is. It is this, my country, my country, my country. Well, you know, if that's your country, get out of my country. That's really the problem. I mean, this whole book, Pat Buchanan's book, focuses, you know, on... And he also says there is a plan, and this is the Republicans, the Democrats, the chambers of Congress, for a reconquest of the Southwest. You know, like all the land we stole from them. They're just going to send all the illegals back into it. And, you know, he says it's like the whole Southwest is going to become like Tijuana. And this is all being aided and abetted by the businesses and the governments and everybody. Personally, I think it is so way too late. It is so, you know, this Trans-Texas Highway that's leading to a Trans-American Highway. This, like, nine-lane, this thing that people think is conspiracy that I'm making up. But you have to look it up. And it is not a conspiracy. It's a real thing. They're starting to build this in Texas, where the highway will go from Mexico, and ultimately it's supposed to go all the way up to, like, Alaska. And... it will allow stuff coming into the ports to avoid the American ports to all be offloaded in the Mexican ports and to just jump on a highway and, you know, go ultimately anywhere in the whole United States of America. And I would think it's probably... going to, you know, would cripple the ports and the, what union runs the ports? The Teamsters or something? The port workers? I don't know. It's just going to ruin this entire country. It's just so obvious. But I think it's too late. What are you going to do? You know, everybody, I would support them all. I mean, Pat starts out with, what is his first idea? Every convicted felon who's not legal, deport them. Why do we need convicted felons in this? I mean, you know, we have enough convicted felons. John Mark Carr. Oh, he's not convicted. You know what I've been thinking of? Oh, my God. Do you know that guy has 3 teenage sons? Just think about them. Just think about, you wake up one morning and there's Daddy. There's Daddy on television saying he killed JonBenet. And then they're, oh, we was at a sex change clinic. And, oh, we was, oh, my God. You know, somebody, I hope they have a college fund for those 3 kids and they cite a psychiatrist fund. Can you just imagine that? Oh, Jesus. All right, wait, where are his solutions here? Because the solutions are in the canopy rollback. A 200-mile double security fence. Okay, that's fine. A federally legislated end to all social welfare benefits for illegal aliens. Sounds fine to me, except emergency medical. Well, see, you can't not send them to school. Then you just have people who are never going to speak English. There's just, I don't know what you do. I just don't know what you do. I really don't. It's horrible. Oh, here, an Eisenhower-type deportation program beginning with all aliens convicted of felonies and every gang member who is not a citizen. Oh, gang members. Who can tell who's a gang member? What do you call Bush? What do you call that? What's going on in the White House? Well, I'll tell you something. Everybody should read this book. I don't care what they call him. I don't care what they call me. And I finally looked at the poster in my corner store where I get the papers. So, of course, the poster, which I think I made deface, since it's all in Spanish. And I thought my store was in America. How silly of me. I should actually deface it because it's all in Spanish. And, I don't know. There's Muslims and people from Arab lands, you know, in my neighborhood too. Maybe they'd want to go. So there is a big pro-immigration march and rally, I guess, on the 7th of September in Washington. That's what it's for. Because I'll have to, you know, when I'm there in the afternoon, it was the morning and I was in a hurry. And, you know, so I didn't have time to, like, examine it because it's not easy for me. It's on Huevos, which I guess is Thursday. Because I see September 7th and it says Sábado, Lunes, Martes, Miércoles. It's Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, but I don't know Thursday, Friday, or Saturday. I don't know why. I forgot those. Sábado, I guess, is Saturday. So this is in Washington, D.C. on September the 7th. So maybe people ought to get ready to counter-demonstrate. You know, bring some American flags and some chants in English in Washington. But I can't believe it. He beat the diet book. I am, like, so psyched. Because it was fabulous seeing the book, like, go up and up and up on Amazon. And then I never in a million years would have ever believed that book, that it could have smashed through that Fat Smashers. Which, actually, I should take a look at that book. I should see what's up about that. Because I have some fat that could be smashed. Lynn Samuels, Serious Left, 146. Oh, my God. Oh, there's a great story here. But somebody is holding on. Larry and Little Rock. Oh, wait a minute. Wait a... Larry.
I spend my lunch hour with Lynn Samuels, and now it sounds like I'm listening to Pat Buchanan with a New York accent.
Oh, God, he would be insulted. Well, what do we do about illegal immigrants? What do we do? I'm not talking about legal immigrants. I'm talking about all these people just pouring into this country.
Well, you got a point there. The thing I really like about, you know, communities like Phoenix, where I used to live down in Phoenix, the different languages, to me, it's nice because I learned a lot. I learned a lot about, you know, how to speak Spanish, so forth and so on. And I just think it's more interesting. It's a more interesting country because people can speak different languages.
Well, what about if the people that's nice in theory? It would be nice in theory to think that so many people were bilingual. But what about the fact that most of those people can speak another language, but they can't speak English?
Well, you know, the international understood language of business is English, and I agree with you on that. You know, when it comes to business, doing business, whether it be retail or whatever, professional corporate business, you know, you should be able to speak English because that's understood, you know, all across the world. But in everyday life, you know, I think it's nice to have that diversity of languages across.
It's nice in theory, but it's not nice when you're trying to order a coffee and the woman in front of you is taking 15 minutes because she can't speak one word of English.
Well, I hear you, but you know what?
And people, where does your family come from?
Well,
you sound like a Mayflower guy for some reason.
No, we're good old-fashioned white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, whatever all.
All right, but wherever, like, when my family came, you know, from Russia or Poland, where the whole idea is you come to America to assimilate and become basically an American. You know, however much of your you know, Yiddish or Russian or whatever you still could speak. But you become an American and you want your children to be an American. I don't see that in these people. I don't see it at all.
Yeah, I hear you. I used to have a lot of fun, though, going into the burrito joint or whatever and ordering in Spanish. It is just a different experience.
Well, to me it's not different because where I live, there are places where they will not speak to you in English. You know, it's like some fuck you. You know, we're here, we speak Spanish, and, you know, if you can't speak Spanish, get out of my store.
Well, and that's just plain rude, and it's pretty bad business, too, because, you know, how many burritos are you going to sell if you don't sell to the...
Where I live, I did that. Believe me, where I live, white people, you know, white English-speaking people are a minority. I mean, we have a Korean restaurant right near me, you know, one of those Korean barbecue, and I've always wanted to go there in the 6 years I've lived there, and I can't go in there because the sign, everything in that restaurant is Korean. It's like, screw you. Either you can read, speak, and order and everything in Korean, or don't come in. So I assume these businesses do okay.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Did you do business in America or anywhere? It's good practice to speak English. I agree with you there, but I really...
Well, that's what drives me crazy.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm just surrounded by people like that. I had that same feeling when I first moved to where I am in Queens. I said, isn't this wonderful, the diversity? You know, that you get on the train. Remember when John Rocker, you know, said that about the subway, about all the weird people? That was my subway, the number 7 train. And they're speaking Japanese and Chinese and Korean and Spanish and, you know, from all the Arabic countries and India. Oh, God, if you like Indian food, come live by me. And I thought it was wonderful, but I don't like it anymore.
I hear you.
Because it's not paired up with English, and I, you know, like to make some accommodation to the fact that I live in America.
Gotcha.
See, so I'm not, I don't even think Pat, you know, who, you know, I wonder about him sometimes. But I don't think even he would care if these people would make some vague, you know, attempt to assimilate.
Well, I've got my own issues with Pat Buchanan, so he'll never get my ear if he's a radio show host, but...
Well, you know, he was a radio show host before he was anything else.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that, but a friend of mine who grew up in D.C., grew up listening to Pat as a radio host. What is your problem with him?
Oh, I just think he's a homophobe.
Well, yeah, he is. No, he absolutely is. I don't think he'd deny it. If I ever get him up here again, I could probably say, Pat, you know, like, he's Catholic.
Oh, well, there you go.
Well, you know, it is, you know, homophobia is just part and parcel of that Catholic doctrine, isn't it?
It's big business for him.
There you go. You know, they're either selling homophobia or molesting little boys. Hardly time in a day. Thanks, sweetheart.
Thanks, Lynn.
Boy, he certainly, Pat has said many homophobic things. All right, now I have no idea, none at all, what this blog is. See, this is the kind of blog you have to watch out for. Because they link to this on Raw Story. And this is called warandpeace.com. Not P-E-A-C-E. P-I-E-C-E. I have no idea what the meaning of that says. Reports on national security and foreign policy issues from Washington, D.C. by Laura Rosen. Laura Rosen. I have no idea who she is. So, but I'll just read you what this says. Because Raw Story is, I don't know, semi, you could believe them. Bush has put out a quiet feeler to replace Rumsfeld. Hoo-hoo. In recent weeks, he was politely turned down by at least one candidate he personally called. Unknown. Is this one of many candidates Bush has sounded out? Is there a Bernanke-style search going on quietly in the background? Posted by Laura, August 22nd at 8:29 a.m. So take that for what it's worth. Who would he have called? Who's like more bloodthirsty and stupid and crazy than Rumsfeld? Remember when the 9/11 Commission, when he finally gave in, Bush, and he at the behest of the Democrats, you know, he never wanted the 9/11 Commission, right? And then the Democrats started making a big fuss about it. So he suddenly pretended it was like his idea to have a 9/11 commission. Does anybody remember who the first person he picked to be the head of the 9/11 commission was? Does anybody remember? I don't know why I do this, because I have no prizes to give out. Oh, I never announced, by the way, that Billy Masters from, oh God, what's the name of his blog? Filth to Go. Or did he change it to BillyMasters.com? I don't know. He emails me everything. He was the one who knew that line I said. Oh, it's August the whatever, 22nd, and the dogs are sticking to the sidewalks. He knew where that was from. I was so amazed. It was from Thornton Wilder's the play The Skin of Our Teeth. And he actually knew that. So I don't know. Does anybody remember who Bush first appointed as head of the 9/11 Commission? Think. I want you all to yell. You're all emailing me. I never look at my email while I'm on the air. And Garrett's not speaking to me. So I'll tell you. It was Henry Kissinger. That's who he first made the head of the 9/11, a war criminal. It was so fabulous. Hello, let's have a war criminal to head the 9/11 commission to, you know, cover up, you know, like another war crime. So, I don't know. You know, you can post anything on the internet. I don't know who this Laura Rosen is. I'm thinking she's the sister. There's some writer who wrote for the National, the New Republic. Leah Rosen. I wonder if this Laura Rosen is Leah Rosen's sister. Anyway, you know, it's a nice rumor, isn't it? Who would want to be the Secretary of Defense now? Like, can you imagine? Can you imagine your phone rings? Hello, this is George W. This is your prez. Would you like to be the new Secretary of Defense? It's like, I don't know. What is it like? It's like, hi, would you like to manage the Boston Red Sox? Now that the Yankees massacred them. It seems like a thankless job. And what difference does it make? He is Rumsfeld does what he wants. And he says, oh, we're going to be in Iraq. You know, we're not leaving as long as I'm president. So what would be the point? To be the Secretary of Defense, you know, and stay there? If he would pick a Secretary of Defense who would look at him and say, you know something, you stupid imbecile, we're getting out of Iraq now. Who would take that job? You'd have to be insane. It's like, did Alex say it this morning? I heard somebody. Who would want to be president? Everybody in America is trying to run for president in 2008. What, are they crazy? Hi, you know, how'd you like to be mayor of Dresden? Oh, I have another great job. How would you like to be the mayor of, here it is, it's like August the 22nd, 1945. How'd you like to be the mayor of Hiroshima? There's a job. Hey, you want to go be the president of Lebanon? There's another great job opening. Oh, I'm going to take a break, and then I have to tell you that Anthony Bourdain show last night was so sad. Did anybody watch it except me? Lynn Samuels, Sirius Left, 146. Oh, all right. We're just finding that clip. I just had to find that on Crooks and Lawyers of Bush yesterday when they asked him what Iraq had to do with 9/11. But there's a piece there that I just see now about that Anthony Bourdain in Lebanon. That show last night. Oh, my God. I just sat there and cried. It was so sad. First of all, I've never seen this guy. Apparently, he's like some famous chef. And I'm not into the chef thing. You know, give me the food, not the chef. But this is a guy, I'd say, in his mid to late 50s. Although he looks really good. He's thin. You know. But he's got an earring, and, you know, he's hot looking for an older guy. And, he's apparently quite famous. He has this show on the Travel Channel where he travels around the world, which is apparently something he had never done. I always forget, is Crooks and Lawyers something that you have to play right off of there, or can we save it? Oh, all right. Can we save it, or do you have to play it right from there? Okay, could you save it? Thank you. He apparently, from what he said last night, this guy had not traveled a lot until the Travel Channel gave him this show, you know, where he started traveling around the world and, you know, I don't know, going to restaurants and eating worms or something. I don't even know what it is, because I certainly never saw the show. And he smokes like a chimney, drinks like a fish. He's my kind of guy. He really is. I think he's gay, probably. And he was in Lebanon, Beirut, with a camera crew when the war started. How long is the clip? It should only be that... Oh, all right. That 2 minutes is fine. So he's with the camera crew, and they're in Beirut. And he shows the first night they were there. There was no war. You know, nobody knew this war was coming. And they're at this place called El Chef, Le Chef, something. It was like a diner. It was like a diner in Beirut. You know, and he's having a lovely time, and he's got this guide. He has this guy taking him around. And then he runs into the editor. I don't know how many Time Out magazines there are. We have Time Out New York was the first one, which is if you come to New York, that's the one you have to buy to know where to go. And there are apparently now 15 other cities that have these Time Out magazines, you know, called Time Out New York. And they just had started Time Out Beirut. That's how hip and happening of a city Beirut, Lebanon was. Is that they had just started a Time Out magazine. And he talked to the editor of that. He had apparently met him, I guess, before the war started. And Beirut was just, everybody had money for some reason. You know, the people in Beirut, they did show you there are people living sort of in the back, you know, like everywhere that you don't see, very poor people. But there were a lot of people in Beirut with money. And the city had just been rebuilt. And the guide and the Time Out Beirut guy both were saying, this is a place where people get along, the Christians, the Muslims. Nobody wants these arguments. Nobody's into politics. Everybody wants to go. They have these gorgeous dance clubs that look like just anything, anywhere. You know, they look like a dance club anywhere in the world with, you know, people sweating and dancing and all dressed up and jewelry. And the war starts. And all these teenage boys are driving up and down the streets in these really nice cars. I don't know cars, but I certainly could tell a new fancy car from like some old jalopy. They're driving up and down the streets of Beirut in these fancy cars, waving the Hezbollah flags. And you could see that guide really was scared. Really, you know, they kind of knew because they've had so much war. And, of course, poor Anthony Bourdain and his crew, what do they know? You know, they're like Americans. And we don't know crap. And the Time Out Beirut guy is, you can see, this guy is just ready to kill himself. You know, because he knows what's coming. And they go out, the first night they go out to a dance club, and everybody is, it's all right, we know there's a war, but we're going to get through this, and we're going to drink, and we're going to dance. And indeed, I kept reading articles all through the war. They never closed those nightclubs, because they were in the center of Beirut, which never got bombed. Well, by like day two or three, somebody was taking care of Anthony Bourdain. You know, I don't know, I guess the Travel Channel or something. You know, they didn't want him to get killed. They don't want to get a whole crew killed or something. And they moved them to, now I should have remembered the name of the hotel. They moved him to a super deluxe fancy hotel in the middle of Beirut. And apparently everybody with money who was trying to get out of Beirut was staying in this hotel. And you have this bizarre confluence of things where they would hear the bombing, which was in southern Beirut, and they could go up to the pool. This must have been just so schizophrenic. The pool is where everybody hung out, whatever floor the pool was on. And of course, I would have gone insane because it's like every fucking person there had children. You know, and they were Americans who lived in Beirut, Americans who were visiting in Beirut, and they all had little kids. And the pool is where everybody congregated, and everybody was calling, you know, calling their family in America and their contacts in Beirut. So he says they would find out, like somebody would be on the phone up at the pool. And they'd say, oh, they're going to bomb X Street. And they'd go look from the roof. And the next thing you'd know, that's where Israel would be dropping the bombs. And he says everything they found out by hanging out at the pool. And at the end, Anthony Bourdain is saying how, I mean, hear how bizarre it is that you're up there, you're at the pool, you're in your bathing suit, you're getting a nice tan, and not that far away from you, people are getting killed and bombed. You know, and all you're doing is they had this guy, what was his name, Mr. Wolf, you know, who's trying to get them out. And finally, they send them, the embassy calls up, and they say, pack, you know, and go to the dock. And they've got the boat, the Marines are there with the boat, but everything is just total chaos. And he says, he's a very interesting guy, this Anthony Bourdain, because he's like not, I don't want to sound snotty. I don't know how to put this. The guy is like not an intellectual. You know, he's actually very unpretentious. I'm sure that what he does, he does really well, you know, but you'd never want to sit down and discuss literature with him or something. But he's, somebody with, I would say sort of limited knowledge, you know, but a really smart person. Cause he said when they were showing the dock, you know, trying to get all the Americans onto some kind of a little boat that then took them to a bigger boat. He said any chef, anyone who runs a restaurant or a nightclub could have run this better. He said anybody who runs a restaurant or a big nightclub or a big venue would have known that you needed like four more signs and maybe twice as many people. And you realize that he was probably 100% right. You know, like this would have been his thing. He would have known how to do this crowd control kind of thing. And they finally get on the big ship on again, I should have remembered. I forget the name of the ship. One of our famous ships. And did he just love the Marines? Oh my God. He just loved the Marines. The Marines were fabulous, you know, cause they had to calm down all these screaming children, among other things. And there were people who, because they lived in Beirut, although they were Americans, they were leaving their homes, their whole life. You know, it was nice they could go back to America, but they were leaving everything behind them. And you could also tell that this guy, Anthony Bourdain, is not as snobby as a lot of chefs, because he said, you know what the best thing was? They got on this aircraft carrier or whatever it was, this ship, And you know, they were eating whatever food, you know, you eat. And it turned out to be tuna noodle casserole and macaroni and cheese. And he says, you know, you grow up, you know, saying that's like the worst food in the world. He said, you know something, it was like the best food I ever ate in my life. It was the best food. Gee, I haven't made a tuna noodle casserole in so long. I should do that. But at the end, what was really sad at the end of this was he said that he had never really traveled, and, you know, that he had started, you know, when he got the TV show. And he had sort of figured out for the couple of years he'd been doing the show that people were pretty much all the same all over the world, And people just wanted the same things, and people were nice, and they just wanted a nice life, and people wanted to get along. And it had some sort of, you know, enhanced and lightened his view of humanity. And that this whole experience in Lebanon, you know, has now made him rethink it about whether people do just want a nice life and sort of to get along and all live together happily ever after. It was so sad. And the other sad thing, because any minute I'm going to get a finger pointed at me that I better take the break now. The other thing that just pissed me off is this. Apparently somebody said, you better explain at the end why you're not covering what happened in Israel. So he had to say, he had to make a point of saying, I wasn't in Israel. I wasn't in northern Israel. We happened to be in Beirut. You know, and that pissed me off that anybody even would think they would have to explain that a second time, since it's obvious that's where he was and that he was there by accident. You know, so it was just really depressing. It's on the Travel Channel. I'll check out. I'm sure they're going to replay it because it was really good and really sad. Lynn Samuels, Sirius Left, 146. Kara in Massachusetts.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi. You watched the show?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I thought it was really good. Did you like it?
Yes, very much.
Yeah, yeah. It was sad. What I thought was sad was when they were standing in the hotel watching the helicopters take all these other people out from other countries.
Oh, well, we knew that at the time, that every other country got their citizens out long before we ever did.
Yeah, that was horrible. Here they are waiting and waiting and waiting, and they're watching these other people leave. And, I think I would have been more afraid of being kidnapped than the bombs themselves.
Well, you know, it's funny. I never would have thought of that, except for that part of the show where their Mr. Wolf, their protector, right, was telling them how to escape, you know, to come up with escape routes. And
that was scary. I thought that was the scariest part.
Who would have cared if they would have kidnapped a chef?
But then you figure, too, all the other countries are gone, and everybody knows there's only Americans left in that hotel, you know?
Yeah, well, I think that may have been a little melodrama, you know?
Yeah.
And then when he said that, you know, now he seems, I don't know anything about him, but he really seems to me like not a political person at all.
Yeah.
You know, and then when he said how angry he was, that here they are trapped, everybody else is leaving, and he sees that scene of Bush on CNN
eating
the roll. Remember when he went, yo, Blair, and, you know, and that, how that pissed him off. And I'm thinking, oh, God, they probably had a big fight to leave that sentence in. Because this guy does not seem like a political. I mean, this guy is like a chef.
He's really cool. I've read his books. He's got a couple of books out.
Yeah, I'm going to have to take a look at it because he seems like it. Yeah.
I think his book is called Kitchen Confidential.
Yeah. And I would never think of frankly looking at a book like that. But
yeah,
after seeing him, you know, I certainly like him. Thanks, hon.
Okay.
Bye. Bye. Okay. See, it takes women to watch a chef. Joanne in Florida.
Hey, Lynn.
Hi. Oh, God, you saw the Katrina show and oh, God.
Yeah.
You must be suicidal by today.
I know. It was hard to get out of bed. I just watched half of the Katrina documentary. I'm going to watch the rest of it tonight. But to juxtapose that against Anthony Bourdain's Lebanon, it was just, you don't even know what to say, Lynn. You just don't even know what to say. Those Katrina victims, they, relate their personal stories. I mean, just bring tissues tonight if anybody else can watch it.
Yeah, it's on just, HBO, right?
Yes.
I don't
horrifying.
Get that.
It's just, these people have post-traumatic stress disorder besides having no homes and no lives. It's terrible. And then you switch over to this poor guy who's over, Anthony Bourdain is in Beirut and showing us how Beirut almost mimics South Beach. And the people, I know Lebanese people, they are wonderful. Wonderful and very moderate. This is the irony of the whole thing.
I know. I have to go, darling. If you want to call back the next hour, okay? But nothing I can do. I'll be right back. that's kinky. And I got my Kinky Friedman t-shirt. See, I should have had more faith in kinky. They did send me, except you know what? It's 50-50 cotton poly. I don't usually wear that. Ugh. I won't usually be, and it did say on the website it was 100% cotton. I was very upset. So, I don't know. It's, and I'll tell you one thing. You walk around in this t-shirt, and this is a wanted poster. It says, wanted Kinky Friedman for Gov 2006. And it's got this huge picture of him, you know, with the cowboy hat and the big cigar. So you walk around, and do people ever stare at you? Because this is like a shirt. Nobody's ever seen a Kinky Friedman t-shirt in New York. Well, except on the engineer for the trucker show. He has one, a different one. So people really look at you, and like when they're looking, you know that they're not looking at like my deformed feet or, you know, my age-inappropriate dress. They're looking at this t-shirt like, what is that? So, I don't know. It's not going to get him any votes for governor. Because anybody from Texas would know. They wouldn't be doing a double take on that. But they did say, I really never thought I was going to get the shirt. I thought, all right, I sent the money for the campaign. But I got it Saturday. Although maybe I shouldn't wear this shirt. Because Saturday, I thought, you know what? I'm going to wear my Boston Red Sox World Champion shirt. And what good did that do the Boston Red Sox? Massacre! Massacre! Jesus Christ! Sweep! Get out the broom! What the hell was that? Those effing Yankees. 5 games. Just a minute. I have to blow my nose. That sounds like so disgusting on the air. I'm going to shut the mic off. Okay. Was that too long? What can I do? So check the Travel Channel. That Anthony Bourdain thing, it may be online. I don't know. I think it's travel.discovery. I don't know who owns all these channels, but I'll tell you one thing. I certainly discovered channels I didn't know I had. Because I had to go online. Because to me, it's like too much effort to look for a channel on the television. So I went online, and do you know we get CNN International? We get, like, the real CNN, not the BS CNN, the American one. We get, like, the good CNN. I didn't know that. And what else did I know? I don't know. I was finding channels, but I kept saying, don't write them down. Because if you start, like, writing that, you know, there's too many channels. Who has time to watch? I haven't even had a moment. I haven't had a moment to watch KFED. I am the only person in America that hasn't had a moment to catch up with KFED on the Teen Choice Awards. But it did say in one of the gossip columns today that he gave an after party and that his performance was so embarrassing that nobody went to his party because they didn't know what to say. They wouldn't have known what to... You know what you say when somebody's terrible? You say, that was an interesting performance, Kevin. That was very interesting. That's always a good word. And I don't think would KFED be smart enough to pick up on that? You know, would he know that you really meant it sucked? What's the other... There was like some other famous thing you were supposed to say to people when they sucked. But I can't remember what it is. I used to know so many people. Oh God, musicians. You just hope they were all drunk, you know, so you didn't have to say anything. I'm so upset that the guy in Keene had to go into rehab. And you know who he's in rehab with? There's an irony to this. They're in the same rehab at the same time. Tom Chaplin of Keene, probably the greatest band on earth, who we still don't have one song from their new album, except that, well, we have one song. We don't have anything from their new album. They had to cancel. They're canceling their American tour. And he's sitting in rehab with Pete Doherty. You know, who is less of a musician. Pete Doherty has reached the point where he's like a drug addict. He's not a musician drug addict. He's like a drug addict. But his, he must come from some family, Pete Doherty. I think I kind of understand what his problem is. Because guess who wrote a book? His mother. Oh, let's cash in on the kid being like a total wreck. Let's cash in on Pete being a baby shambles. I don't know, if you were like a drug addict, would you want your mother writing a book? That doesn't seem very nice. So there's Tom Chaplin in rehab with Pete Doherty. I don't know. I wouldn't want that. Oh, God, that guy's, his poor children. The JonBenet kill. You know, they're like all these weird things coming out. If you go to Drudge Report, by the way, here's the link to a video. The National Enquirer got a video of him singing and playing the guitar. Can we play that? Can you go to Drudge and like click on that video when it goes to National Enquirer? It's 4 minutes, but I just want like the beginning. Let everybody else go find it themselves before it crashes. If it's on Drudge long enough, it's going to crash. Where is it? It's up at the top. It's the second one. It's up above Iran, because it's more important than Iran, because this bozo child lying pervert, it probably crashed already. Oh, all right. Then I wanted to sing. Okay. Find it yourself. It's at the National Enquirer, and it's on, it's, what is it? NationalEnquirer.com. Or drudgereport.com. Get to it before it crashes. All right. I did say, I would say to him, keep your day job, because you're not much of a singer, but his day job is molesting children. So you don't want to say keep your day job. There are like two really, there are three weird things. Now, I don't think he did it. I think he's just like a crazy person. But there's the way he signed his high school yearbook, did you see that story? That he signed his high school yearbook with four initials, like, I will be the conqueror or something. I forget exactly what the phrase was. But he had just the first letter of each word, and that those same four letters were on the ransom note? What the hell was that about? And they've got one handwriting expert who is willing to stake his entire career, because they apparently got a high school yearbook he had signed from somebody, you know, in his class. People are making so much money. He's like an industry, isn't he? Isn't he? Can you imagine how much the National Enquirer paid for that home video? Oh, my God. Everybody who ever knew him is like just digging out all this stuff they have. What do you think the National Enquirer paid for a home video of this guy? $50,000-$60,000, I hope. And then somebody got the high school yearbook that he had signed. And that was, I don't know, I guess it was everywhere. I saw it on MSNBC yesterday, you know, where you could see what he had written. And there was some, one of the foremost handwriting analysts that there is, is staking his entire career. He says that is the same handwriting as on the ransom note. So who knows? I mean, like anything can happen, and it's a lovely distraction, frankly. Isn't it a nice distraction from Iraq, from Lebanon, from, Iran was supposed to kill everybody today. And all they did is, I guess they've come out and they've said, we'll talk to you. It's more than Bush will do. They're ready to enter serious negotiations. But Bush is going to say he doesn't want to talk to them. Because that's Bush's thing, you know. If you don't totally agree with Bush, he's not speaking to you. That's all. He must have been such a great father. Can you imagine that? That's why those two girls are so screwed up. You notice something interesting? The horrible Bill Clinton, you know, who destroyed the concept of family and morality and whatever. His daughter just loves to hang out with him, doesn't she? She just loves to hang out with her mother and father. And those two girls, it looks to me like they can't stand to be with their parents. So who's really sticking up more for family? It looks to me those girls never want to be with them. You know, one of them is taking a job in like South America. You know, Bush is never going to go there. So it's very interesting about who has a real family and who doesn't. Now, I know it's different because Chelsea is an only child, which is, that's a whole different story. But these girls, they're sort of, I don't know, when you're twins, are you like an only child? Because you're like totally equal. It's not like the one comes and then the other one comes and takes over. I just ruined Andrew Wilkow's entire day. And he doesn't, but you know what I love? I love these young people who you tell them something and they look at you as though you're insane. There's really no point in somebody my age even speaking to a person, I don't know, probably under the age of 40. Certainly under the age of 35. Because Andrew Wilkow, he's on the same time I am. Well, he's on actually 12 to 3 because he has more energy. On the Patriot channel. Because we're not Patriots. We're the left channel. I hate that they call that the Patriot channel. And like, what are we? Why don't they just say it's a scumbag channel? The Democrat channel? The commie channel? But they're the Patriot channel instead of the right channel. Didn't they used to call it the right, serious right? Weren't they serious right and we were serious left? And then we stayed serious left. And they became the Patriots. All right. Well, what can you do? I know what a Patriot is. So Andrew Wilkow is the, he's the big thing now. He just started here a couple of weeks ago. And, I don't know whether he still says it. He used to say, you know, I forget what the, you know, it's like he's the future of talk radio. He's the young whatever. And, you know, quite a fuss is made about him. And I just saw him about an hour ago, and I said to him, you know, Andrew, how's it going? He said, oh, fine. I said, you know, I hope you understand how it works here. Like, in 6 months, you're going to be old potatoes. And he looks at me. And... because this is not like an old-fashioned radio station. You know, there are all these channels here. It's not like there's five or six people on the air. And they're always hiring people. And my God, when I started, oh, God, I was just I was so important. And then, like, 6 months later, they've already, you know, by then they've hired God knows who. And, you're like nobody after a while. Not that they're not still nice to you, but you're not, it's not all this big brouhaha. You know, here's Lynn Samuels is here. It's like, oh, God, that bitch, you know, have to deal with her every day. And I said to him, well, you know, because they'll hire somebody else and they'll just get used to it. Well, the look he gave me, I should realize that when somebody is on the right, that the idea, you know, that the idea of reality is just beyond them. But he'll see. He'll see. He's the golden boy today. And, you know, by the middle of winter, old potatoes. But now he won't even, like, smile and wave at me anymore. I'm trying to be friendly to him. But I can see there's no point. All right. Oh, it's time for a break. Lynn Samuels, Sirius Left, 146. How come Pat doesn't mention Shelley, his wife? Oh, God. See, this is where you realize Pat Buchanan is not that great of a person. Who does he thank in his acknowledgments? Michelle Malkin. Oh, my God, Michelle Malkin. No, oh, Patrick. I don't know. Why doesn't anybody mention Shelley, his wife? Oh, my God, no. He's Catholic. He wouldn't leave her. All right, where was I? I don't even remember what I was talking about, because then I started looking at the book. In between, which totally took my mind off whatever it was I was speaking about, since nobody listens to my show anywhere near me. I was talking about the handwriting. Oh, I know what we need to do. We need to hear this clip of Bush from yesterday. Now, I don't have all the clips. You know, you need a whole staff to go back and collect every comment made by every person since 2002 talking about Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. Do you know that if you want to join Al-Qaeda, you have to make out an application form? Where do you get those? I was just reading, you know, the judge threw out one of the charges against Jose Padilla. You know, not Padilla. Padilla is not how he pronounces his name. Padilla. And the article, you know, goes to Lynch, because she claims that what's in this particular charge is actually in the other charges, so he would be being tried twice for the same thing. I don't know. It's, I think the judge, they point out in the article, actually, that the judge seems to think this whole case against Padilla is, you know, pretty much a crock, which we know. But in the little article about Padilla, it says here that the defendants, I didn't realize this, they just stuck his case onto some other terror case in Florida because they didn't know what to do with him, because obviously he didn't do anything. And they've only been holding him since May of 2002. This poor guy. Padilla is accused in the indictment of filling out an Al-Qaeda application in July of 2000 to train for violent jihad. Where do you get an Al-Qaeda application? Like, what do they ask you? Do you go to the post office, like, where you get a tax form? Where do you write? Do they have a website? Is there, like, Al-Qaeda.com? And you know, when you just say, could you please send me an application? I didn't know you had to, like, make out a form to join a non-state terrorist organization. They're so bureaucratic. Bureaucracy, you know, is just everywhere. Isn't it? Is that like the craziest thing you ever heard of in your whole life? So, oh my God. Live rattlesnakes released in Snakes on a Plane Theater. You know something? Can I retire from the human race? Two live rattlesnakes were released in an Arizona movie. You know, whenever I fall in love with the state, it's all over. During a showing of Snakes on a Plane, pranksters released young venomous rattlesnakes in a dark theater at the AMC Desert Ridge in Phoenix. The two snakes, oh God, what's, this has to be teenagers. This has to be teenagers. That to me is very scary, said Herpetological Association Representative Tom Whiting. I would hate to be watching a movie about snakes and have a rattlesnake bite me. Wranglers were called to collect the snakes. No one was injured, and so far the culprits have not been caught. Officials believe the snakes were smuggled into the theater in backpacks. Oh my God. The snakes were to be released in the desert. Oh, what a riot. What a riot. Now are they gonna, oh, you can't bring a backpack to the movies. Oh, that is the funniest story I ever saw. I'm gonna have to post that. It's on Drudge Report. Okay. So Bush had that press conference yesterday where he made that fabulous statement that we're not leaving Iraq as long as he's president. You know, which just, made me say, okay, that's fine. You don't have to be the president. You can leave anytime. Save us all that trouble, wouldn't it? Just save all that trouble of impeaching and everything. But he also said that Iraq had absolutely nothing to do with September 11th and that nobody in his administration ever said it did. When, of course, that's all they said. So do we have that?
Suiciders. To kill innocent life, who had relations with Zarqawi. Imagine what the world would be like with him in power. The idea is to try to help change the Middle East. Now look, part of the reason we went into Iraq, the main reason we went into Iraq at the time was we thought he had weapons of mass destruction. It turns out he didn't, but he had the capacity to make weapons of mass destruction. But I also talked about the human suffering in Iraq. And I also talked the need to advance a freedom agenda. And so my answer to your question is that imagine a world in which Saddam Hussein was there, stirring up even more trouble in a part of the world that had so much resentment and so much hatred that people came and killed 3,000 of our citizens. You know, I've heard this theory about, you know, everything was just fine until we arrived and, you know, kind of... stir up the hornet's nest theory. It just doesn't hold water as far as I'm concerned. The terrorists attacked us and killed 3,000 of our citizens before we started the freedom agenda in the Middle East. What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing. Except for it's part of, and nobody's ever suggested in this administration that Saddam Hussein ordered the attack. Iraq was the lesson of September 11th is take threats before they fully materialize, Ken. Nobody's ever suggested that the attacks of September the 11th were ordered by Iraq. I have suggested, however, that resentment and the lack of hope create the breeding grounds for terrorists who are willing to use suiciders to kill to achieve an objective. I have made that case. And one way to defeat that, defeat resentment is with hope. And the best way to do hope is through a form of government. Now, I said going into...
What is he talking about? You know, that's the kind... You could play that 50 times. And then there's that part where he, like, mutters something where you can't even hear him. What does... It is so embarrassing. It is so incredible. What is he talking about? How is this man the president of the United States of America? How is this possible? He's babbling. He doesn't understand what he's talking about. I love that reporter. I don't know who that was. I guess we should know who that was. Ken, obviously. But he, like, just, here's the president of the United States just babbling incoherently, and he, like, yelled out at him. That's the kind of thing that you wish would happen more often, that reporters would do. But he said, what did Iraq have to do with that? You know, and he just interrupted him. But what in God's name is Bush talking about? Plus, how can Bush be saying nobody ever suggested that Saddam Hussein ordered 9/11? That's all they did suggest. Jeez, he has, like, no grip on anything. He has no grasp of any. Is he drinking? What is going on? I mean, God merciful heaven. At least half this country just say, apologize to the entire world that we have allowed this man to become president of the United States. I just don't understand it. It is so horrifying to me. I can't even, I'd rather think about the guy that, you know, didn't kill JonBenet Ramsey. Give him some more champagne for taking my mind off Bush. Lynn Samuels, Sirius Left, 146. Okay. I'm sorry. Everyone who can hear me on the satellite, as an American, I apologize. I apologize. Gary in Richmond.
Remember when Bush said that his job would be a lot easier if he were the dictator?
Yes, I do. He said that three times until apparently somebody told him to cut it out.
I think we ought to impeach him and then ban him to Iraq and make him the dictator decider over there, but not allow him ever to go into the zone. That'd be the right sentence for the guy.
That sounds good. I like that. That's good. Don't let him in the green zone. Just send him over to Iraq. See how he lasts 10 seconds.
Yeah, have a good day.
Okay, bye.
Thank you.
Oh, that was good. Wait, you have to hang up. He doesn't want to hang up. All right, I hanged up on him. Is that English? I doubt it. There's a long piece on Consortium News, which is real. I don't know if I have a link to that. Did I have a link to Consortium News? Yes, I do. Not by Robert Perry, who runs it, but by, I don't know, some guest writer, about how Bush needs to, number one, be impeached and then taken to, like, The Hague or something and tried as a war criminal. That's what needs to happen, because that's what he is. Worst, I mean, I think Bill Clinton was a war criminal. For that Kosovo crap. Oh, we didn't see the train full of civilians coming off the bridge. Well, what were you doing there in the first place? You know. So that wouldn't be a bad idea either. To see what's new. What's new? What does Ross story have? I want to see more about Bush trying to fire Rumsfeld. That's such a good rumor. John McCain says Bush misled nation on Iraq war. Wow! What, John, you woke up! Congratulations. Nobody's going to vote for him this time, are they? Are they going to vote for John McCain this time? Because he's getting, like, I don't know, all these Republicans who turn on Bush. You can't trust them, because one second they'll turn on Bush, and then, like, the next minute they're for something terrible. You know, there's still Republicans. Oh, by the way, according to the latest poll, Lieberman and Ned Lamont are now in a statistical dead heat. It's like Lieberman's 44, Lamont is 42, which makes the dead. And this poor schlep, this Schlesinger, this poor Republican. That nobody wants him. The Republicans don't want him. Apparently, Lieberman is running campaign ads on all the right-wing blogs. He's putting his campaigns up on, like, powerline.com. This is the weirdest race, this Connecticut thing. But this poor goon, this Schlesinger guy, you know who you ought to team up with? I am the perfect pair of people, politically. Katherine Harris. Because they are like the two Republicans that the Republicans don't want anything to do with them. You know, Katherine Harris. No Republican in the state of Florida wants to go near that woman with a 10-foot pole. Even though she is printing lists of all the people that support her. And then the newspapers call them up. It's like all the Republican elected officials in Florida, the state legislators. And newspapers call them up and they say, I don't support her. What is she using my name for? And she had a campaign rally over the weekend, Katherine Harris, in an airplane hangar somewhere. And it was this big, huge airplane hangar, and there were, like, practically no people there, and she had listed on her flyer all these state elected officials that were going to come, you know, and they're the ones who said, I don't support her. And she says, oh, well, it only looks like such a big airplane hangar because we had rented another one, but a tree fell on the other one and damaged it. So we had to move to this bigger hangar. So the newspaper calls up the airport. And the airport says, I don't know what she's talking about. That's the hangar she rented. We didn't have any tree fall down on anything. This woman is like a psychopathic liar. She just is incapable of telling the truth. It's the funniest thing. So this nut job in Connecticut who has, I don't know, what, 5, 6, 3, 4, you know, single-digit support, Mr. Schlesinger and his wampum card. That's what got him in trouble. Nobody wants any part of him. One of the things Bush said at the press conference yesterday is not getting involved in Connecticut, which really all that means is I'm not supporting the Republican. So poor Alan Schlesinger is going to Washington looking for support from the Republicans. But the last sentence of this article is what's really funny. Schlesinger declined to say who he planned to meet with during his visit to Washington, D.C. Because probably nobody. Nobody wants him. Nobody's interested in him. This guy couldn't win if he was the only person in the race. This is totally Lamont. And you notice something interesting? The primary is Ned Lamont won, right? And now, all anybody talks about is Joe Lieberman. It's like Ned Lamont doesn't exist. Where is he? Is he on television? He's the guy who won the primary. And all you see on TV day and night is Joe Lieberman. Which just goes to prove something. Do you realize that without money, you can't, that's it, you're finished. And Ned Lamont even has money. And yet nobody is paying any attention to him. Nobody believes in the electorate. Nobody believes in real, freedom of the people to nominate who they want. The only reason Ned Lamont got anywhere is because he's so personally wealthy and can put so much money into his own campaign. And then we have our own insane person in New York. This woman, this Republican nut, challenging Hillary. This KT McFarland, I don't know who the hell she is. She's some Republican woman that nobody ever heard of. And she announces she's running. And she says Hillary is sending helicopters to spy in the windows of her apartment. And then she says her father molested her when she was a child. And then her brother comes out and says, insane maniac. But in the meantime, she walks around like all dressed like a Republican lady. You know, she just walks around and she's all like, you know, about white gloves and hats. You know, real throwback. You know, and her whole, this whole family feud erupts in the papers of New York. You know, with her entire family saying our father never molested anybody, and she's just, you know, like a total bitch. And the whole family just trading insults all over the place. And, you know, in the meantime, Hillary is spying from helicopters into her fancy Park Avenue apartment or something. Well, she is suspending her campaign against Hillary. KT McFarland, because over the weekend, it seems her 16-year-old daughter got picked up for shoplifting, not from one store, but from two stores. From two different stores. Fancy schmancy, and not just little shoplifting. You know, to me, when you're 16, what is shoplifting? What is shoplifting? You know, you take a lipstick, right, from Woolworths. What did you shoplift? What a boy shoplift. Don't dare tell me you never shoplifted. Candy. Yeah! All right, boys take candy, girls. Even I took lipstick, even though I never liked makeup. No, not Katie, not when you're a Republican running against Hillary Clinton. She stole a pair of designer jeans and two really super-duper expensive bikinis. This daughter of our next senator. And the people from the store followed her to a coffee shop and confronted her. And she said, I need to go to the bathroom. I can't believe this. This kid's very brazen. She says, I have to go to the bathroom. So she goes to the bathroom, she comes back, she takes her shopping bags into the bathroom with her. Gives you an idea. And they go through her shopping bags, and lo and behold, their bikinis from their store are not in there, right? So they go to the bathroom, and she had taken the two bikinis she stole and hidden them in the ladies' room of the coffee shop. And this happened over the weekend. But KT McFarland, senatorial candidate, her husband didn't tell her till she got home from campaigning over the weekend. Because he didn't want to tell her on the phone. So she is now suspending her campaign until her daughter gets the help that she needs. So I think that this woman and Catherine Harris and Alan Schlesinger, you know, should have like a menage a trois or something. You know, that maybe they ought to go on a retreat for futile campaigns, lost causes. The lost cause Republican retreat. What kind of lunatics are these people? I certainly don't understand it. Oh, God, it's just the worst story. I don't know how I'm going to break this to you when I come back. Just prepare yourselves, because I don't know how we're going to get through this. How come Iran didn't kill us all yet? Lynn Samuels, Sirius Left, 146. Oh, God, I don't know how to break this to you people. This is like the worst news. There were these hailstorms in Italy, and there is going to be a big shortage of pesto. I know, it's a shock. It's a shock to me, too. The big pesto shortage. Because apparently, it's only certain basil in Italy that you make the best pesto from. And this basil is grown in greenhouses. And there were these huge hailstorms. And they smashed all the greenhouses. So, like, people in Italy are going to have to be eating inferior pesto. I just don't know how people are going to survive this. I really don't. But they will. You know, I read this, the BBC, I should post this. The BBC had this very interesting article about musicians in England and this ban on carrying anything but the smallest hand luggage onto airplanes now. This is very interesting. So musicians can no longer take their musical instruments, right? They can't take their musical instruments on the plane with them anymore. Do you know the people who have cellos have to buy another ticket? People who own a cello have to buy a ticket for their cello because it doesn't fit in the thing. And one guy says not only did he have to buy the ticket, but just to get back at them, he would order kosher food for the cello. He would say, my cello needs a kosher meal. So, because of these new restrictions, they're ruining people, musicians' careers. Because people have these instruments, violins, mostly it's stringed instruments, that are worth tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? And you're not going to let somebody take like a $50,000 or $60,000 or $150,000 violin, no matter how you pack it, and throw that into the cargo hold of an airplane. You are just not going to permit that to happen. Because there's the temperature thing, you know, that can crack the wood and ruin the whole sound of any stringed or reeded instrument. So there are musicians that can't play overseas anymore, that they can't take any job where they have to take their instrument and get on an airplane. And the only thing they can do is, like, take a you know, like drive to another European country, except now they're saying all the EU is going to do the same thing. I'm going to post it because what's most interesting is not even the article. It's all the comments from the musicians at the end of the article about how do they expect us to take like a $50,000 violin and let them fling it around. You know, like a piece of baggage. All right, my cello needs kosher, and my trombone wants a vegetarian meal, please. All right, if Iran doesn't kill us, we'll be back.